good afternoon, everybody, and thank you so much for being here today. On behalf of the Department of Justice, we are thrilled and excited to be a part of this amazing conference, and we really look forward to sharing some helpful information. And I also encourage you to fill out the survey, only if you liked it. So if you like the presentation. But we will take any critiques as well, because that always helps. So, I also wanted to say my colleague David Knight would have been here. He had a conflict, and I was thrilled to step in. But Mr. Knight is a trial attorney also with the Department of Justice and our Disability Rights Section, and does a lot of work working with IDF and working with individuals with immune deficiency disorders. So I just wanted to thank him in his absence for inviting me. His name is David Knight, David K. Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T. You'll get, I believe my contact information will be up. If anybody wants to reach out to him or me, I can reach out to him through, you can get to him through me if you would like to. But we can get started. So today's session, of course, is about your rights in the workplace under the ADA, FMLA, and disclosure rights and responsibilities. So I will just get started. Hopefully this will work here. Oh, great. What are you going to learn today? Today you're going to learn about your rights as an employee with really any disability, but we'll talk a little bit about primary immunodeficiency. Your right to take leave for medical treatment for you or a family member, because the ADA does have some protections for our family members, even if you are not the person with the disability. And where to go with future questions. Okay, so the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, protects individuals with disabilities. And I was mentioning to a participant today, that the definition for disability, which we're going to talk a little bit more about in detail, differs between what context you're looking at it. So for our purposes, we're going to talk about the definition of disability under the ADA. So it protects individuals with disabilities as defined by the Act in employment, public services, and public accommodation. So public services would be if you're going to going to a courthouse, and if you are vision impaired and you need assistance at the courthouse, that's a public service that is covered by the ADA. Public accommodations could be when you go into a CVS and you need to be, or a bank, and you need to reach the teller, and you might be a wheelchair user. They are also obligated to accommodate individuals with disabilities. So they're covered. Basically, everybody's covered. All walks of life, pretty much. And who does the ADA protect? So this is where we get into the definition under the Act of what constitutes a disability. Someone with a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. I cannot tell you how much case law there is on substantial limitations of major life activities. Prior to, it seems common sense, but it is not. I had a case when I was a trial attorney with the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in Philadelphia, and there was a case against a major construction company who offered a gentleman with diabetes a job, and when it was discovered during the post-offer pre-employment medical exam, which is another thing we'll discuss, that he had diabetes, they rescinded the job offer. This was a young man in the prime of his life. He had a wife and a child. And there was litigation over whether diabetes was a disability. So there was some questions about whether it really substantially limited a major life activity. I did. I'll say it settled. I'll say the case settled, but it was for a nice sum. That's okay. That's all right. So we're getting into that. We're going to get into that right now. So major life activities. These are some of the major life activities that we're going to talk about, substantial limitations. So first, it has to affect a major life activity. Jumping is not a major life activity, and running is not a major life activity. But walking, speaking, breathing, seeing, hearing, thinking, which we'll talk about in a bit, but there's a new, Amendments Act of 2008 really incorporated cancer into that. So cellular reproduction is a major life activity. Things that if you weren't able to process certain things or thought processes and reproduce blood in a, I guess, quote unquote, normal way, you would have some serious illnesses as a result. So major bodily functions, immune function, endocrine, reproductive, and normal cell growth. So that normal cell growth would encompass the cancers. Reproductive major bodily functions could include hepatitis C. It could also include certain cancers like cervical cancer, uterine cancer. Substantially limited factors. What does substantially limit mean? And what are the courts, how do the courts actually examine this when they're looking at how we define substantially limited? They look at the nature and severity of the illness. So if you have a cold or the flu, you may feel like you will never get up again, and you may feel like you're absolutely disabled, but the flu is not a disability, because eventually you will be healed from the flu, and it typically only lasts for a couple of weeks, hopefully, not longer than that. So that will go to the second prong. How long will it last, or is it expected to last? And also, is it a permanent or long-term impact or expected impact? So now the cases are looking at even things that last a period of 6 months can sometimes be seen to be a disability under the ADA. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a lifelong illness. Also, someone can be regarded as disabled, and someone associated with a person with a disability is also protected. For example, your employer cannot terminate you because your husband has terminal cancer, or your wife, or your daughter or child. Believe it or not, there are some employers who have made those unfortunate employment decisions based on association. Title I, there's three titles of the ADA. Title I applies to employers. So private employers, so the US EEOC litigates cases against private employers. So Fortune 500 companies all the way down to any company that employs 15 or more employees. State and local governments, that's where Department of Justice comes in. We look at police departments, fire departments, schools, any state-funded entity, county government, state government. So we go in and look to make sure that to enforce the ADA against those employers. Employment agencies, so agencies that refer out temporary or permanent employees, they cannot discriminate based on the ADA in referring out persons for employment, and labor unions. So those are all entities. The ADA applies to all of these various categories. And I said 25 earlier, so I meant greater than 15. Oh, Title I does not apply to employers with less than 15 employees. So if there is maybe a local Dunkin' Donuts that's a franchise that only has 10 employees, they're not covered by the ADA, the EEOC can't swoop down, and neither can anyone else under Title I of the ADA. There might be some state laws that protect those employees, but we would not. The executive branch of the federal government, so it doesn't apply to me, I don't think. Private membership clubs, so I imagine various country clubs, and Native American reservation churches and parochial schools. If it's a state-funded charter, then it would be covered. But if it's a private school, I don't think so. And that, again, this is in the employment context, because I believe the private schools would be covered under Title III for, let's say, your child is going into a school and they won't admit the child because maybe the child is HIV positive or has some other maybe mental health issues. So Title III would be where you would go for help with that situation. So Title I covers all employment practices, including recruitment, compensation, et cetera, training, tenure, layoff, leave, and firing. So all of these categories, it would cover all employment practices. So before you get hired, when you're hired, and if you're let go, or when you leave. So all in every stage of employment. Okay, so this is important. Who's not protected? We talked a lot about who is protected, and this is what the ADA currently says. So current users of illegal drugs or abusers of prescription drugs. However, persons who do not currently use drugs illegally or who are in the process of drug or alcohol rehabilitation may be protected. So it's not a guarantee. If you're in rehab for whatever reason and you relapse, there could be some protections there. I definitely have seen a couple of allegations considered on the EEOC's end where they're mulling over whether to pursue that context. So again, with we're still under who is protected and what is a qualified individual with a disability. We talked about what a disability is. Let's talk about qualified, because this is another way an employer can defend itself by saying, even though you may have a disability, and the employer makes a decision, say, oh, I'm not going to hire you, or you're fired, they can say, look, you're not qualified. You can't do the job. So again, this is another term that's actually people split hairs about, and there's litigation about what is qualified, so there's a definition. A person who meets legitimate skills, experiences, education, and the biggest thing is who can perform the essential functions of the job with or without a reasonable accommodation. Another heavily litigated, these two terms, essential functions and with or without a reasonable accommodation, are very, very heavily litigated. Interestingly, in a lawsuit, when you go through what's called a discovery phase, when each side exchanges information and you're trying to find out, okay, so employer, tell me what the essential functions of this person's job was. You say, I'll go back to the construction worker example. He was one of the essential functions that the employer said was, okay, well, employee X is supposed to be able to operate a backhoe on the road, and because he has diabetes, he could pass out from diabetic shock at any given moment, and because of that, he can't perform the essential function of the job, which is driving the backhoe. And we can't accommodate him in any way, so we can't do it with or without a reasonable accommodation. That is interesting because if you look at sometimes they'll give you a list of essential functions of a job, or sometimes it'll be pre-existing. And believe it or not, driving a backhoe was not listed as an essential function of the job or in the job category or the job description when it was advertised and say, you need to be able to drive a backhoe. And then sometimes you'll find in litigation that you'll get these these job postings or these job descriptions have been revised since the litigation began, and all of a sudden something that was menial is now very essential. So that's something that the employers may use to say, well, this person is not qualified, therefore we have not violated the law. So here's something that is very important if you are an individual who believes that they might have been discriminated against. In terms of meeting the qualifications, because there are certain responsibilities that the employee must meet in order to meet the definition of qualified. So do you have the education, training, and licenses? Licensing is also another issue where employers try to be a little tricky, requiring CDL licenses in order to do something pretty basic that doesn't require commercial driving at all. But if you do, if sometimes a job legitimately does require commercial driver's licenses or education licenses or certain amounts of training that maybe you just don't have. And so while the employer may not want you to work for them because they have a disability, because you have a disability, if you don't meet the qualifications, they can easily say that you're not qualified and therefore you don't have a case. And can the individual perform the essential functions of the job with or without a reasonable accommodation? And we're going to get into more about what reasonable accommodation is. So we kind of talked about this a little bit, is functions are required to perform, essential functions are those that are required to perform the function. If I have a job that requires me to drive, I should at least know how to drive. So that's pretty basic. The employer's judgment is important. So even though you have these, sometimes the litigation, these brand new, revised job descriptions, the courts are very hesitant in most cases to second-guess an employer's reasoning or judgment as to what is important for the job. I mean, the timing of the revision can look suspect at times, but overall, if this has been the case for many years, the courts are not going to say, well, I don't know, employer X, this doesn't really look like an essential function, but it all depends. But employer's judgment is important. If they deem something to be essential, then it's probably going to stand. So we talked about written job descriptions. They're very, very useful. And the focus should be on the results that are accomplished. So like the construction worker, at the end of the day, what is he supposed to accomplish? What does success look like for that construction worker? Is it how frequently he drove the backhoe 10 feet a day, or is it on the other parts of his job? And also the employers have to consider, well, what happens if he doesn't do that? I think, you know, for the most part, that the site will be completed. So employment tests. So there are certain employment tests that employers can give. Sometimes now a lot of employers are using personality tests. Sometimes those are used to weed out mental illnesses. Sometimes they do intelligence exams. So they have to meet certain standards, but blanket exclusions are unlawful. So if you take an exam and they just completely exclude you, there's probably a problem. So what is a reasonable accommodation? So if you do meet the definition of disability under the ADA, you are entitled to a reasonable accommodation. So your employer has to begin a process with you. You indicate to your employer, hey, I have this issue, I'm going to need an accommodation, and then you start a dialogue. And reasonable means a feasible or plausible and must be effective. So if I am a wheelchair user and I say, I need a ramp to get from the parking lot into the building, and he says, and your employer says, okay, no, but, you know, we can figure, maybe you can use a ladder. No, that's actually not effective. So, you know, the employer can't, and it can't just stop there. There should be some more back and forth. But it does not have to be what you prefer. It can be something that you come to a compromise on. And a reasonable accommodation, I'm going a little fast because I'm running short on time, but a reasonable accommodation can be a variety of things, and you're going to see some of those, but the accommodation process can happen in the job application process. So if I'm doing something online and I may need a paper application or any other type of accommodation, if I'm vision, hearing impaired or what have you, you can ask for accommodations at that point. That would require some level of disclosure, so that would be up to the potential employer. So, and the rest of these, you can see, you can get accommodations for any point of your, a reasonable accommodation, any point of employment. And the interaction process we talked about, that's when you go back and forth with your employer to try to come up with something reasonable that will work for the employer, that's not unduly burdensome to the employer, not unduly costly. And a lot of times when the employer does work with you, you do come up with something. So these are different types of reasonable accommodations. So acquiring or modifying equipment, sometimes you might get need. You might have a back issue and you might need a raised desk. You might need an extended lunch or maybe change your lunch hour in order to accommodate maybe diabetes or other type of illness that requires you to eat at a certain time. Providing assistance. So if you're vision impaired, sometimes individuals ask for a reader or a different computer equipment like JAWS to help with reading. Job restructuring, modifying policies depending, and a modified work schedule or a leave. These are all different types of allowable reasonable accommodations. And reassignment to a vacant position. This is one that employers sometimes don't realize is lawful and under the law, under the ADA. If there are no other reasonable accommodations that you can give a person with a disability, the employer is then obligated to assign you to an open position. It has to be open. You have to be willing to go to the position. It doesn't have to be the same pay. It can be lower pay. So they can move you to a different lower paying job. So there are definitely some parameters, but that is an obligation that the employer has if there's a vacant position within a certain time frame of your request for reasonable accommodation. And a request does not have to be in writing. If you verbally ask for an accommodation, the employer is obligated then to engage in an interactive process. So like I was talking about no undue hardship for the employer, that's another that's really the one of two defenses that the employer has is, oh, this is going to be too much on my business. I can't afford this. There are some parameters that the employer must meet in order to make this undue hardship argument. That's been done with me, and I've had the employers make, give me, if it's cost, then I want to see your spreadsheet, your budget. I need to see what you spent, how much money you really do have, and how much money you really could spend on this. I mean, if I find that the defense is really not made in good faith. Direct threat. So employers may require that an individual not pose a direct threat to the health or safety of individual or others. That happens. That happens a lot in many different contexts. But many years ago, and hopefully it doesn't happen as much now. But individuals with HIV/AIDS were excluded from many many different job categories because employers just assumed they would pose a direct threat in any context. So. With more education, I think the employers are learning that that's not really going to work with a lot of these immunodeficiency illnesses and diseases. So, this is a list of things that the employers must show in order to make that defense. When can an employer inquire about a disability? Before making a job offer? No, never. They can't. But they can ask about ability to perform specific job functions and make an offer conditional on the passing of a post-offer medical exam. Those we also look at very closely. And after making conditional offer and before an individual starts, sometimes. So this may happen in the context of the medical exam or health-related questions if everybody's required to take the same medical exam. But once the employee is hired, there shouldn't be an annual re-examination to make sure the person is still healthy. We see that sometimes. It's not recommended. For employees, medical exams must be job-related and consistent with business necessity. So sometimes nurses, they're going to need to take a medical exam before they are hired on as a permanent. So that's just one example. Employers may never ask genetic questions soliciting genetic information, including family medical history. If you see any of those questions on a job application for any state, local, or private business and you're applying, you need to contact the U.S. EEOC or myself because that is against the law. Confidentiality, there's requirements for employers to keep their personnel files confidential and separate, so your medical information has to be in a separate file from your personnel. It can't be intermingled. And so this is some information about drug testing. So here's who enforces Title I, the U.S. EEOC, and there's a process that the EEOC goes through. Now, that's if it's a public employer or private. EEOC enforces private employer cases only. They litigate private employers. The Justice Department will litigate against public employers. But no matter if it's an employment case, your charge has to go to the EEOC first. There's field offices all over the country for the EEOC, and I highly recommend that if you feel that you're discriminated against, you can talk to an investigator before you file a charge. They can help you screen your issues and make help you make the determination whether or not to file a charge, or you can just file a charge. So, and if it's against a public employer, that charge will find its way to the DOJ. And maybe my desk. So here is the EEOC's information. You can go on www.eeoc.gov. They have 53 field offices, and often you only have 180 days to file a claim or a complaint from the date of the unlawful action. Sometimes it's 300 days, but you have to check with your district or field office to find that out. So the enforcement and remedy for ADA violations is a lot like in other civil cases. You get back pay, front pay. Front pay is if you're 55, you're leaving work, you had to leave work, you were terminated, or maybe you didn't get the job, and maybe you would have worked for five more years till you're 60. So you ask for pay that you lost and pay that you would have gotten were it not for the discriminatory action. Compensatory damages, so for that individual in the construction case, he got compensatory damages for emotional harm because the employer did intentionally not hire him because he had diabetes, and it definitely caused him great pain and anguish. And sometimes reinstatement. Sometimes the employer is just uninformed, and they're willing to, once they get sued or they think they might get sued, they come around, and then they want to work with the employer, which is always a good resolution because we want the employee and the employer. We would love for that, you know, to happen, to be reinstated or to be hired where the individual really wanted to be in the first place. And this is a FMLA. This is basically entitles any eligible employees to 12 weeks of unpaid job protected leave for specified family and medical reasons. So FMLA is really an excellent, it's an excellent protection for those who, if you can afford the 3 months, but at least when you get back, you know you have a job. So this applies to businesses with 50 or more employees within 75 miles or a public agency, and you have to have worked at the employer for at least 12 months. So this, the FMLA, you're eligible to care for a child, a spouse, or a serious health condition, which you do have to disclose in order to get. You have to disclose the fact that it's a medically related need and whatever other parameters your employer has set up. And this is the definition of son or daughter. And what constitutes a serious health condition. And the Department of Labor Wage and Hour Division enforces FMLA. So Department of Justice does not enforce this, but you can always refer to us and we can point you in the right direction. And if you have a sometimes leave issues come up with the ADA, and employers who have a cutoff time for leave, let's say they have you can only take 12 days leave after that you're fired. Those are not good because right there it cuts off the interactive process. It doesn't identify what issue is there. What could we do for you? Is there some accommodation? That completely cuts off that obligation. And so mandatory leave cutoffs are not advisable for an employer. So, and sometimes these extended leaves may last longer than FMLA. Okay, so I think that's my information up there. I think I might be able to take some questions now. If I have, okay, excellent.